the ability of a really great guide is to manicure and evolve a safari based on what his guests or her guests are after. So we get first timers who've never walked on grass barefoot, ever.
Welcome to the Curiosity Shire, where we uncover the stories behind ordinary people living extraordinary adventures. Our mission is to help you discover your own adventure, find the courage to pursue it, and ultimately live a life filled with purpose and satisfaction. Greetings, friend. My name is Seth, and I will be your host during today's conversation. This is episode 6 of the Curiosity Shire podcast. I honestly cannot believe that it's already episode 6. Time has flown by, but there have been so many incredible conversations, so many just inspirational guests that we've had on the show, and we have a couple really cool conversations coming up, including this one. This one is, I had a conversation with Lee Fuller, who is a safari guide in Africa. The thing I love most about Lee is just how incredibly humble he is. This guy leads tours for the rich and famous, you know, people, Hollywood actors, just billionaires. They come and explore Africa with Lee, but he isn't starstruck by the lifestyles of his guests. Instead, his passion is introducing these people to a world where they can take off the pressures of society, of fame and fortune, and just connect with nature. And I really love, during our conversation, we kind of dive into what is the goal of life? You know, you can have all this money, you can have all this fame, but is that truly better than having no money and living in nature? Or, you know, I mean, that's kind of extreme. You probably want some money, but connecting with nature is very important, and finding that balance. We kind of dig into that during our conversation. We also discuss why it's important to reconnect with nature, especially for those of us who live busy lives in man-made environments. As a nurse working in the capital of Iceland, I actually never wanted to work in a hospital. Funny story, I might get into it at some point, but here I am working in a hospital, and I absolutely resonate with the need for nature and time away from the hecticness of modern life. Lee shares why being a safari guide is such an important occupation and how he ended up stumbling into the job as a lifelong career. I also asked him about his tours to Madagascar, and he shared some sobering facts about the animals who live there, which just might surprise you. It actually surprised me, so you'll enjoy hearing more about the country of Madagascar. So with all that being said, let's get into today's conversation with Lee Fuller. Lee, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast here. Thanks for coming on the Curiosity Shire and sharing your stories.
My pleasure, Seth. It's good to meet you, and looking forward to chatting.
Absolutely. Where are you located, just to start off with, where are you located right now? Where are we chatting from?
Right now, I'm on my friend's veranda, which is a South African word for porch, in a little town called Greyton, which is about 2 hours inland of Cape Town, in a place called, the greater area is called the Overberg, and I'm gazing over a green garden full of beautiful trees and a blue sky and birds tweeting.
It sounds absolutely lovely right now outside here in Reykjavik. It's the wind is blowing, the rain is falling sideways, it is freezing. Yeah, I really want to be where you are right now.
Yeah, no, it's not bad. I've just moved down to the Cape about a month ago, and just after 7 o'clock in the evening, and it's still blue skies and sunshine, and we're kind of winding down the day, but not a bad place to be.
That's awesome. Tell me, kind of what got me interested in hearing your story is I connected with you through Grant. You were doing some stuff with Grant Folds, and I started looking up what you do, and you have a business called Lee Fuller Safaris. Give me a general overview of what that's about.
Yeah, so Grant, I crossed paths with Grant a couple of years, well, 3 or 4 years ago now, at a summit, the World Youth Wildlife Summit, where they'd asked me to do some Master of Ceremonies work there. And yeah, I just was inspired by him, and we kind of got along pretty well from the get-go. And we've stayed in touch over the years, and my Lee Fuller Safaris, well, up until March 2 years ago, I still am, but I haven't done anything for 2 years. I'm a private guide, so I take mainly American families on privately guided photographic safaris into Africa. We do South, Central, East, West, Madagascar I go to a lot. But over the last 2 years with the pandemic, I've sort of had to juggle and jive and jump and whatever, and have found myself working a bit more closely with Grant in more of a conservation space. And yeah, so Grant did mention it. We're working together on a rewilding program in KZN, my home province, on the east coast of South Africa. And yeah, so kind of my safaris, which are thankfully all looking good for the second half of this year, holding thumbs that they do happen, will be interspersed with kind of some conservation, some NGO work, some work with kids. I had a kids adventure education business for 10 years. So yeah, pretty much just outside animals, nature, wilderness, guiding, rewilding. It all kind of melts into one pot quite nicely. And it's pretty much what I've done for the last 22 years. Yeah.
Wow. So I'm curious, what kind of got you into going back in time to the safari adventures? What started that for you?
Well, I grew up on what they would term in North America a cattle ranch. We called it a farm. And yeah, my parents, just keen outdoorsmen, dad obviously a farmer. And yeah, we were very seldom too far from a pair of binoculars or a fishing rod or a shotgun or a rifle. We just grew up, yeah, kind of a very privileged existence. What I thought was perfectly normal. I thought everybody in the world was like me, barefoot, running around with your Zulu mates and yeah, just living the dream in terms of a quintessential old school childhood. And kind of that evolved into an interest in the outdoors, in birding in particular, which dad kind of got me onto. And then, yeah, those sort of teenage years when sport and girls tend to take preference, I didn't lose my way, but I just lost a bit of focus on what I really knew I was good at and what I wanted to do. And I thought I'd be a professional sportsman for a while, but that only lasted about 2 weeks. But anyway, we kind of in 2000, I signed up with a company called Singita to be a trainee guide there. And I kind of looked at it as potentially a bit of a gap year thing. In those days, it was pretty much a gap year or two guys would get into the industry and then go and get a proper job. But 22 years later, and we are still at it and loving it, enjoying it. Those first 10 years, I was a lodge-based guide. So essentially, I was based either in the Kruger National Park or the Sabi Sands or the Serengeti. And that was kind of 10 years of living in the bush. And now I sort of live in a normal house, in a normal place. But I get to travel into Africa and lots of countries and lots of camps and have met some amazing people. But yeah, all instilled by pretty much growing up on the farm and spending 100% of our time outside.
Wow. And yeah, you're still in your gap years. Someday you're going to go get a real job, right?
I have to be a little bit responsible because I have a 5-year-old daughter, but I still can hold my own on the playground with her, even at 47, which isn't that old.
I think it's really important to, you know, like you said, it's what some people consider as a gap year, gap year work. But I think it's so important to realize that, you know, we can kind of do whatever we want, you know, whatever fills our soul and really just makes us feel alive. And for you, it's, you know, doing these safaris, which I can only imagine how incredible they are. And if you get paid for it, hey, that's the life you want to live.
Absolutely. I think I've got a few, I love quotes and sayings. And one of my favorite is, if you love your job, you'll never work another day in your life. And you know, you can read a lot of those motivational books and that, and I actually don't read a lot of them because I find it's the same message, and that is the message, and they manage to string it out into 17 chapters and repeat themselves, and it irritates me. I love reading, and I read all the time, and I read lots of books, a lot of nonfiction, but I think, yeah, if you find something that you enjoy, you more than likely are good at it, and it will lead you not necessarily into fame and fortune, and you you got to prioritize. Do you want a decent family life? Do you want lots of money? Do you want a great lifestyle? Do you want an impact on? Yeah, and I think you can tick all of those boxes, and not necessarily in that order. And that order will change as you mature and evolve and gain an experience. And yeah, I think the bottom line is, when you do something that you love, you tend to do it quite well, and it's fun. And yeah, it does pay for dog food and school fees. So there's a lot of advantages to doing what you love.
Yeah, and I think that's so important, talking about your priorities in life, because it's kind of funny, because you can look at a super successful lawyer or super successful doctor and be like, oh, he has so much money. But in order to get to that point, they had to give up so much. Like, lawyers work constantly. They're always asked to be working, especially if they work with big firms. Doctors, as a nurse, like, I know how much doctors work and how much time they put into residency programs. So, you know, you just kind of have to look for what is your passion and what are your priorities, and then not look at other people. You know, stop looking at other people's success, because they went down a different path than you did.
Absolutely. I think, you know, this comparison of yourself constantly in this society where it's hard to keep a low profile, even if you wanted to, and you kind of are exposed to everybody else's successes and good stories and their holidays and the social media debacle that we're all bloody part of, frustratingly, you do end up comparing. And it's kind of, I've gone through stages of ups and downs through most of my adult life in terms of, geez, maybe I should go and get a proper job now. But repeatedly, it happens, you know, not often, maybe once or twice a year, where a hugely successful friend of mine that I haven't seen from school for 20 years goes, geez, mate, you're living the dream. Like, I would give anything to do a job. And I said, well, you're like a millionaire with a 5 cars and a huge house and a, you know. And he's going, no, it's not worth it. It really isn't worth it. And I've missed out on my kids, and I love the bush. And yeah, so it's tremendously humbling when you are pursuing what you enjoy and what you are good at, and not focusing on comparing yourself to society. And yeah, I think this whole societal norms, you know, obviously the last 2 years of the pandemic, we've all had to look inward and change and, you know, pivot and blah, 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 all those words that we now are very used to. But it's been a tremendously humbling experience to realize that, even though I haven't done a safari for 2 years and I've had to, you know, live off capital and sell stuff, and it's been tremendously liberating. I'm with my friends now, and we've been talking actually for the last hour about how liberating it is. We've been forced into these moves to a new place or selling capital items, and it's always like a grudge, sort of, oh, I've got to get rid of that, and you can't get as much as you want. But actually, everything that leaves your possession in terms of a material item is lightening the load, and it simplifies your life, and happiness prevails. It's just incredible how I should be as miserable as ever with, you know, overdrafts and stress of monthly payments that I don't know what I'm going to do next month, but I've never been happier. And it's kind of a bizarre thought, because yeah, material things just do not count ever.
Yeah, and I think talking about the societal norms, somewhere, somehow, you know, we've kind of glamorized the people with all the shiny cars, the 5 cars, the mansions, and maybe, you know, maybe they're just showing it off to make themselves feel better because they've given up so much to get those.
Yeah, no, it is. It's pretty interesting. You know, I read an article this morning that popped up, and it was like one of the Kardashians, I don't know which one, is now the first girl in the world to have 300 million or whatever it is Instagram followers. Like, woohoo, let's give her a gold medal. Like, what are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Like, that cannot be what society has deteriorated to. But the reality is, there it is in black and white. She's the most followed, admired, or whatever the word is. And it's pretty heartbreaking at times. But I do think that there's just such inspiration to be taken from, you know, the I don't know who the top 100 or the top 1,000, but there are plenty of amazing people doing amazing things. And with every sort of door that closes, there's another one that opens. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think that's something important that I'm trying to do with this podcast, because I don't really look at how many people follow potential guests on Instagram or social media. oftentimes the coolest people living the coolest lives don't have time to post everything on social media. And I just feel like sometimes our markers for success are just a little bit off. But I'm curious, so talking about the fact that, you know, you haven't chased the money, you aren't loaded with all these riches, but instead you've chosen to do these safaris and do this passion. So I kind of want to talk about your passion for wilderness. What keeps you going with, why are you at it still 20 years later, doing guiding?
I think it's the incredible position I find myself in with some of the world's most influential and successful people. You know, these are businessmen that are, they've just done phenomenally well in their respective fields, and they're with their families. And whether they're a billionaire in their own jet or a little bunch of, you know, school kids from the development school next door, it's just reconnecting people with nature. And I think that as guides now, whether you're a fishing guide in New Zealand or a ski guide in the States or a safari guide in Africa, our jobs are now probably the most important in the world, and this reconnection of people with nature is just the most inspiring thing. And we in guide training, when I was trained and I've been involved in training guides, we always say, like, see it through your guest's eyes. Like, we see impala, it's one of the most common antelope species here, and you literally at the end of a safari will have seen thousands of them. But remember that those guests, even if it's their third safari, this is their first impala of their third safari. Okay, so they used to looking at traffic lights and sirens and buildings and concrete and you know, smog in Manhattan or wherever they're from. And I think this ability of Mother Nature to heal, it's just incredible. I mean, with all the social ills and the sky high levels of depression and suicide and all of this, and yes, there's medication and there's clever people that'll help you through that, and those work, but it's this massive disconnect with nature that is probably at the root of just about every single one of those, especially the mental illnesses. And reconnecting people with nature isn't rocket science. You know, we're not forcing it down their throat. We just sort of, you know, they're just immersing themselves into Africa, and Africa is apparently the most revisited tourist continent on this planet. And there's an ancestral connection with Africa. You know, you get off the plane, be it in Nairobi or Dar es Salaam or Joburg, and there's a smell in the air. There's a familiarity. We've all been here before. We all originated in the dark continent, on the dark continent. And it's the sun, it's the sounds, it's the smells, it's the going out, whether you're on a vehicle or on foot, and it's kind of, I've been here before. So there are these incredibly strong ancestral connections to this continent and to safari in particular, because it kind of winds the clock back. So whether you're a Forbes top 5 billionaire in the world and you have been in the top 5 for the last 10 years, if you don't behave yourself out in the African wild, especially on foot, the elephant's gonna squash you. He doesn't care who you are. Yeah. So I think
he hasn't read your resume.
I think it's just the most incredible process watching families who arrive from wherever, you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and the bees are buzzing, like there is a swarm of bees around their head, and the kids are fighting and they're on their phones, and mum's crapping on dad, and dad's grumpy because he lost his, you know, iPod speaker, whatever thing, on the plane on the way over, and the bees are buzzing, and you know, I'm you know, pouring very stiff G&Ts on the first day at Sundowners, but it's just watching these humans reconnect with nature, and I'm the conduit. I'm like just a very narrow thread in the whole thing, but watching lions hunting, having a big elephant bull come and push a tree over in front of the car, walking down a riverbank and into a riverbed following the tracks of a leopard. I mean, it's just the most, I think, underrated experience and powerful experience, and a reconnection with nature that if we don't do that, we are going to spiral into all sorts of problems, the bigger picture of humanity.
I think it's interesting too, because you have such a unique job. It's not like you're presenting something synthetic or man-made. You're not working in a corporate environment. You're literally introduce, you're just facilitating people's meet up with nature, and you just kind of stand back and watch, you know, you keep them safe, you kind of guide them through it, but you just watch. And that must be an incredible experience to watch different people, because different people probably react differently too.
For sure, Seth. I think the ability of a really great guide is to manicure and evolve a safari based on what his guests or her guests are after. So we get first timers who've never walked on grass barefoot ever. And we get experienced wow. safari goers that have been to Africa 30 times. You know, they're addicted. They're serial offenders. You know, most of my family's, in fact, about 90% of my family's come back. And so I've, you know, we come back to Instagram followers. I don't have a lot. But I've got a very small database of tremendously cool people. So yeah, I think that repeat business, I think the fact that everybody does react differently, everybody comes with fish to fry, you know, like some people are here for X, some people are here for Y, and you've got to try and figure that out as quickly as possible. And then, yeah, when you've done one trip to them, and it's often, you know, I meet guests for the first time in Madagascar, and about half my trips go to Madagascar, and there are not a lot of other private guides that do Madagascar, so that's a nice little sort of niche for me. But once they come back, once I've gone to have coffee or lunch or whatever with them in the States, you know, I try and get over to the States every couple of years to do a bit of catching up. And yeah, you get to know these people, and yeah, they sort of arrive. It's a very cliched thing, but they arrive as guests and they leave as friends. But I truly believe that yeah, this standing back and watching it evolve and tweaking it and adjusting it every now and again, it's an absolute privilege, and it's just amazing to watch.
I'm curious, is there, I don't know how to frame this question, but is there an experience that really stands out to you from somebody, or are there some incredible people who stand out that you could even share who they were? I don't know how privacy works with guided safaris. Working as a nurse, you know, patient privacy is huge. But yeah, anything you could share, like from certain experiences that people had on their first time in Africa?
Yeah, Seth. So from a privacy point of view, you know, we don't sign a Hippocratic Oath, but yeah, for me to name drop names, I'd be an idiot, because that's not what I do. And I'd be very fortunate to have met famous, successful people from Hollywood, from sports, from business, you know, just leaders. And it's just been unbelievable. So these are men and women whose time kind of cost is measured per second. And I'm spending 2 weeks with them, having three meals a day with them, you know, like taking their kids, you know, shark cage diving or whatever, while they go and taste wine. And I mean, it's just the most unbelievable. I've had dinner with people. I you know, I still have to pinch myself and say, I had dinner with like those people. I sat at their table, you know, in their home. And anyway, it's, yeah, I think we all get excited, and the big names, you know, are amazing people to meet, because they often are not what you see on the screen or in the newspapers or whatever. Mm-hmm. They're just normal people. And I think that's so humbling. But I think one of the greatest things out of all the people that I interact with are not only these high profile, you know, high net worth individuals or families that are grounded and humbling, and they still, you know, kind of, I mean, I hate to say old money, but that is kind of, I'm very privileged to have most of my families are like that. And you then immerse them into Namibia, and you take them into camps where nobody has a freaking clue who they are. And I think that's so awesome to see. Like, maybe one of the other guests might have a suspicion that is, you know, whoever. But obviously a lot of these people dress down, and like, I think just for, you know, like Jim Carrey said it famously, I haven't guided him, by the way, I'd love to guide him. I think he's one of my heroes, but he said famously, I wish everybody would become Richard Famous just to realize how crap it is. You know, these are people that can't go to try on a pair of sneakers at the shop or buy some milk without being harassed. So yeah, I think to be with these people when they have the opportunity to just be themselves and just be anonymous again, And the people in Africa, you know, I think these unscripted, so we have these safari itineraries that are, you know, that to the minute, and we know who the pilot is and what time the charter and what color the plane is, and we often know this detail a year out, and it's high profile people, and there's often, you know, a little entourage of maybe a bodyguard or two. But anyway, the amazing thing is are these unscripted kind of unexpected interactions with people on the side of the road or people in the airport or you know, somebody at the lodge that they just connect with. And it might be the surfing guide or the diving guide, and they maybe not even wanted to dive, you know, and this guy or girl just gets on like a house on fire with these people. And I think that these beautiful human relationships, and I mean, yeah, at the start of this interview, I was frustrated because I had to get a different browser, and I just like, oh, if I have to do another Zoom meeting, I'm going to slit my wrists. But I think now post-COVID, especially post-COVID, but this was something I noticed, you know, years ago, is that these human connections, and as the world speeds up and as we become busier and as social media and devices tend to wedge their way into us more and more, I just do think that these human interactions, so whether it's the family themselves, the siblings getting along, or mum and dad getting along, or me getting along, but it's these often these unscripted, delightful interactions in the middle of nowhere. We'll stop under a tree in Kenya for tea, and up pop two little herd boys who are like 10 years old, and they're looking after, you know, 150 goats. And we've got kids who are like 12 and 13 who you know, aren't allowed out the back door without a tracker device or something on. And here are these little dudes who are like, how's it, what you doing? And then they might have a little football or a lacrosse stick on the back of the car, and then you're playing lacrosse with the Maasai. I mean, that's just priceless. I think those are some of my favorite interactions.
That is so cool. And you also do wilderness adventures for kids as well. So speaking of kids, tell me about those trips, because those are catered solely for, I mean, I'll just premise this by the more time goes on, the more we get like kids with devices, the more, you know, computers, kids are in such a sterile environment. And I think it's so important what you're doing. So tell me about some of those programs.
Yeah, so Seth, I had a business for 10 years that I sold just before lockdown, and that was an adventure education business that I pretty much ran when I wasn't on safari. So I'm generally away sort of 100 odd days a year. So for the rest of the year, I ran these trips from home, and they kind of started by default. And I am, yeah, full of ADHD and I'm a grown up kid. So energy wise, I've always got on with kids, and it kind of defaulted from, you know, taking a couple of my mates kids fishing, and then it was like an overnight camp, and yeah, we eventually had some schools signed up, some of you know, some really premier schools, and we would facilitate journeys and expeditions for these kids where they'd go on. One of my longest trip was 21 days, where we'd have 100 girls in five groups, and they would have everything they need on their backpack, and they would hike most days, and other days they would ride a mountain bike or ride a horse or paddle. So we'd sort of kind of just take away watches, take away phones, take away distractions. Let's replace all these, what they perceive as real problems. So these are sort of early teenagers. They're going through puberty. I mean, puberty for me was hard. Puberty for my dad was hard. But puberty for the teenagers today is like climbing a wall. It's just, yes, when you throw, yes, social media and the devices into it, like it's just harder than it's ever been. And really taking these kids from usually quite privileged backgrounds, as well as some sort of very rural school kids. And it's just, yeah, once again, reconnecting them with nature. And it's something that I sort of sold at the beginning of lockdown to focus entirely on the safaris and really get my safaris going. And yeah, timing wise, I mean, who knows what could have or would have, or it doesn't matter. We here we are now. And I've actually resurrected a little division of that business. Was my favorite, and it was just eight kids at a time. They were all, you know, between 7 and 13 years old, so all in primary school or junior school. And we went on these little two-night campouts, you know, myself, another guide, and eight kids, and we did all the wilderness skills and bushcraft skills and campcraft skills that I did as a kid, just growing up being a farm kid in South Africa, which we all did. All the farmers, we camped, we made fire with wet wood, we tracked animals, we caught fish, we gutted them and ate them. And I just, as I said in the beginning, I thought that was normal for everybody. And nowadays, that is completely abnormal, even in Africa and even in amongst the sort of farming communities and the outdoorsmen, is that because mom and dad, I have to work to you know, make ends meet, is that the kids are sort of left to a bit to their own devices. And yeah, they'll default to the screen, as will you and I. You know, I'm no saint, definitely not. And yeah, given the first opportunity to, you know, hit Netflix go instead of reading a book, yeah, I'll do it. But yeah, then I have to open my book again, and or my data runs out or something, so I can't finish watching Netflix. So yeah, that kids business has kind of really given me an opportunity, I think, so a USP, a unique selling point of myself, and what I really enjoy are families, and I tend to enjoy families more because I love kids. I've got a 5-year-old daughter who you know, is just the most beautiful thing in the world. I tend to, on safari, do the best when there's families and kids. So yeah, I do have enough energy to wake up early and go on a game drive or a walk and then entertain the kids the whole day and then do an afternoon drive and sit at dinner. Although sometimes I do, especially after some good wine at dinner, get a bit sleepy before pudding. But yeah, I tend to use those 10 years of running that kids business and I incorporate it into safari, where, yeah, I can really not only entertain the kids, but I think, you know, especially the younger kids, they're more pliable, they're more moldable, they're more open, they're all ears rather than kind of got their own opinions yet. And there's nothing wrong with your own opinion, but it's just let me expose you to this and let me tell you about deforestation and poaching and human wildlife conflict, and you guys are picking up the ball soon. Within the next decade, you're going to be sitting behind desks and you're going to have conservation issues and human issues coming at you. Whether you're a software designer in Boston or a fashion model in Paris, you're going to have to think about the environment and animals and wildlife and those kind of things. And yeah, so I just love to have the opportunity to plant the seed in these kids' ears.
As you were talking, well, first off, actually, we could hear on the recording this bird in the background cawing. What kind of bird is that?
So that's a hardy-dar ibis, and they are famous. Well, actually, they're notorious for being the loudest birds in Africa. And when I grew up, you know, I learned to speak Zulu as a youngster, much to my mother's horror. I was more fluent in Zulu than English as a kid, and she kind of was worried about my schooling going forward. But in Zulu, they call Nkankan. So whether it's an Nkankan or hardy-dar, it's an onomatopoeic name for a very, very noisy bird that tend to gnaw when you should sort of be sitting on your veranda having a gin and tonic, or even worse, when you are catching the last 10 minutes before your alarm goes off, is they hugely, hugely intrusive. And so that was a hardy-dar ibis or an Nkankan, and yeah, you almost are guaranteed to hear them on every single safari in Africa, that's for sure.
That's really cool. It was fun hearing that. But no, when you were talking, I remembered this. It was a comic strip that was in, I think, I can't remember if I saw it online or in some newspaper. And it was basically this black and white drawing, and there was a city that was kind of just smoldering and just pretty desolate in the background. And these kids were in the foreground, and this guy in a suit that was very ripped was standing there. And it was like the year 2050, I think, was written. And the guy in the suit said, yeah, the world has kind of, what did he say? The world has come to an end, but for one brief moment, we created so much value for our shareholders. It's so poignant because it's like, you know, the way our capitalistic economy and society runs is, oh, how much money can I get? How much value can I create for the shareholders? And we kind of hit a point where, you know, we're just innovating. And then the environment was like, hold up, like, you're gonna really, like, just take me out. You know, you got to think about the environment too. So, yeah, when you were talking, I was thinking about that. And it was such a poignant picture that I still remember about how, you know, it's all about priorities. Yeah, we've come to the point where we can actually destroy the earth, which is not great.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm also going to refer to a comment in replying to you. Sorry, I'm going to refer to a comic, a little diagram that I saw. And I do think that, yeah, humans have this incredible capacity to not get along. and the little diagram I'm thinking of is the first frame is two people shouting at each other. So the whole frame is just their faces, and there's just like the obscenities, you know, all the question marks and stars. And then the next picture, it zooms back, and it's a whole lot of people shouting at each other. And then it zooms back, and you can see that these two crowds are standing on either side of a river, you know, no wider than a dining room table. And then it zooms back, and you can see they, you know, in Europe, or they might be in France, let's say. And then it zooms back, and you can see that in Europe. And then it zooms back, and, you know, eventually you've got the world, and there are these little squabbling signs and dust and smoke and exclamation marks, and there's the world. There's like the sea and Africa and whatever. And yeah, these people are, you know, at each other's throats. And I do think that in terms of environmental education and saving the environment, and it's something that's, you know, we had COP17 and there's all the, unfortunately a lot of it is gesturing and greenwashing and that, but I do think that the kids, And Ian Player, who was the famous conservationist, and maybe your chat with Grant Folds, he mentioned Ian, who pretty much saved the rhino and what was exceptionally important in wilderness areas and conceptualizing, you know, John Muir, the concept of wilderness and why do we need wilderness. And, you know, he famously said, if we don't pass the baton on to our children, the baton of you know, environmental education and environmental responsibility, we're going nowhere. Because you and I, maybe we're on our last lap, you know, some of us are in the stands already, but the kids are, you know, tying up their shoes. Some of them are on the start line. Others might be on lap one. But yeah, you and I are I think as adults going to need to make sure that our kids understand these big picture problems and yeah, it's them that are going to have to make the impact. You know, we're not a very, well, I certainly am not very proud of this generation. You know, we've made a right real stuff up of our world in terms of the environment. So yeah, but we do have the capacity to pass the knowledge and the experiences and the hope onto the children. Yeah. So it's an important job.
And I think one of the ways of passing that on is exposing them to nature and showing them what they're fighting for. Because once you're not gonna be passionate about something until you love it. And yeah, having those experiences is so important. You mentioned that doing safari trips to Madagascar is kind of a niche that you have because not many people do it. Tell me a little bit about Madagascar, because I'm actually kind of curious. What kind of safaris do you do there?
It's exactly like the Disney movie. It's interesting how that movie, you know, you say I go to Madagascar. Oh, is it really like the movie? It is. So the world's environments, the world's sort of biological spaces are measured what they call these biodiversity hotspots. So the Amazon jungles one. The outback in Australia is one. The you know, the forests in Russia but Madagascar, in terms of biodiversity hotspots, is if not the hottest spot in the world in terms of 8 out of 10, 4 out of 5 of every plant, animal, frog, bird, butterfly, dragonfly that you find in Madagascar only occurs in Madagascar, and that's endemic. So endemic means it doesn't occur anywhere else. And when we talk about saving environments and saving species and whatever, yes, save the rhino, yes, save grasslands in Africa, but there's a lot of them. There's not a lot, but yeah, the point I'm trying to make is in Madagascar, that is it. When we eliminate, you know, there's 102, 103 species of lemur now, unfortunately 17 already extinct lemur species. One of them was the size of a gorilla. And once it's gone from Madagascar, Seth, it's gone. So there's kind of a lot of wildlife NGO focus on Madagascar. There is that, it's kind of a word like Zanzibar, Kilimanjaro, or Serengeti. It's almost a brand, and it has this incredible curiosity to it. Well, I certainly felt that, you know, Gerald and Lee Durrell, and I was intrigued by them as a kid because firstly, he was a very funny writer. And secondly, his wife's name was Lee, which I was quite horrified to work out that my name was also sometimes a girl's name. My mum said I was horrified for weeks. I didn't want to talk to her. But anyway, I've always had this like fascination with this island that as a kid I thought was like the other side of the world. And then I when I could read a map, oh, it's just across from Mozambique, you know, I could probably paddle my canoe across. But I think that it has this attraction and this brand and this mystique to it. But I also think that, yeah, I in terms of legacy, I need to get as many people to see it as possible. Not because, it is disappearing, but I think the people that I can take there can have an influence. You know, they have the ability to say, right, stop. You know, we're not cutting any more trees down. There's only, you know, 450 of this lemur left. Let's get on to it. You know, and I think things like, you know, voyages of discovery and Madagascar has an ancient history of piracy. You know, the biggest names of the piracy in the Indian Ocean, you know, pulled out in Madagascar. You know, Madagascar is only 1,000 miles long, but down in the south they get 1 inch of rain a year, and it's a desert essentially. Up in the northeast they get 5.5 meters of rain a year. So it's where the rainforest meets the sea. So you just have this tremendous biodiversity. So different habitats, different rainfall, different climates, different aspects. So the windward and the leeward side of the mountains, you've got, you know, mountains, and you've got this huge coastline, and yeah, within it are these endemic, you know, the lemurs are the big attraction. The you know, King Julian is a ring-tailed lemur. He's like the most famous lemur in the world, and he's one of 100 and something. Yeah, yep, 100. Yep. I think it's 103 now. So obviously the scientists are at it. They reckon they've still got 30% of the frogs to discover, and taxonomically name. So that's just absolutely bizarre to think that they still haven't found all the animals in Madagascar. And yeah, taking people there, I mean, it is, I think wonderful is probably quite an overused word, but from a, you know, the aqua blue azure seawater and palm trees and white sands and amazing corals and diving and fishing, and then onto these forested or dry forest or grassland habitats, and then lemurs and leaf-tailed geckos and half the world's chameleons. And yeah, just a tremendous experience. And then culturally, a very, very cosmopolitan culture, you know, quite recently been settled by humans, you know. So initially they thought it was 2,000 years ago, but now they reckon it's sort of maybe 15,000 years ago. But a very Indonesian, Malaysian influence. And so those people arrived in Madagascar, not straight across the Indian Ocean, but they came all along the Asian, you know, Indian peninsula, and then yeah, eventually collected some Africans and then headed across. So you have this tremendous, tremendous cultural immersion experience where, yeah, it, you know, even if you didn't see an animal or a bird, the people are just the most incredible people you'll ever meet.
That is incredible. Definitely on, I kind of dislike using the term bucket list sometimes because I don't want to keep it all confined. And but yeah, that's on our to-do list. I would love to visit there someday. Maybe we'll sign up for one of your safaris.
I'll be honored to take you, mate. We'd have great fun.
This question might, you may have an answer, you may not, since I didn't give it as a pre question, but kind of to wrap things up, is there a funny story that just really stands out from your time guiding? Could be an animal encounter, could be people, could be yourself, something you you encountered, but just, yeah, really funny story from your guiding experience.
How long have you got? How many stories can I tell? I'm trying to think of the best one, but I mean, some of my fondest memories are actually the people I met, the staff that I worked with. So you know, 22 years ago, I started at Singida as a very wet behind the ears. I was like 25. You know, we were single, we were wild. I still am single and wild, but it's not much has changed there. But I just think that the kind of behind the scenes stories, and there's been a few books written about the sort of shenanigans that go on at these top end lodges and hotels, and I've now told you where I had worked, and so I'm going to end this conversation right there and say, you know, maybe around a fire, when I swear you to secrecy, I'll share some of the better ones, but definitely not on any electronic media.
On the recording.
Definitely not. But yeah, I just think that Yeah, probably some of these sort of unscripted things where, you know, this is Africa, TIA, stuff goes wrong regularly, and kind of, yeah, just the most beautiful human interactions where you've got, you know, these people that have traveled all over the world and been in the best hotels and stayed in the most amazing places, and then you're immersed into Africa, and you know, you're trying to eat lunch and there's a lemur running under the table, or a baboon having a number two off the thatch roof onto the deck. So it never ends. We laugh a lot on safari.
Yeah, always an adventure. Well, hey, how can people listening to this, how can they contact you if they're interested in learning more about your safaris or booking a safari?
Yeah, so I have a website, which I think is very cool, done by a friend of mine, and we redid it over lockdown now, and fairly active. Well, I am active on Instagram. I'm learning the ropes there, and Lee Fuller Safaris on Instagram, or leefullersafaris.com is the website, and yeah, all my contact details are there. Drop us a line, email, phone, give us a shout. I can't always answer the phone because I'm often up a tree or down a hole or whatever, so yeah, just pop us an email. That's probably the best email. I get to my emails at least once a day, usually.
Awesome, I love it. Well, thank you so much, Lee, for coming on. I have thoroughly enjoyed this and can't wait to share this conversation, and I'm inspired. Hopefully we can visit Africa soon.
Cool, Seth, thanks for having me, and yeah, keep up the good work, mate. I love what you do, and it's been cool to chat this afternoon.
Thank you for visiting the Curiosity Shire and listening to today's conversation. If you haven't already, subscribe to this podcast and come join the conversation on Instagram at Curiosity Shire. This episode was edited and produced by Agnes Grettersdottir, with music by John Bentley and Grand Mercy. And I'm your host, Seth Sutherland, wishing you all the best until we see you again here in the Curiosity Shire.